Green Mars, cassette 12.
The workshops were held in gazebos scattered through the parks or in three-walled rooms in the public buildings that edged these parks. The Swiss had assigned small groups to run the workshops, and the rest of the conferees attended whichever meetings interested them the most, so that some involved 5 people, others 50. Nadia spent the first day wandering from workshop to workshop, up and down the 4 southernmost segments of the tunnel. She found that quite a few people were doing the same, none more so than Art, who appeared to be trying to observe all the workshops, so that he caught only a sentence or two at each site. She dropped in on a workshop discussing the events of 2061. She was interested, although not surprised, to find in attendance Maya, Anne, Sachs, Spencer, and even Coyote, as well as Jackie Boone and Nergal, and many others. The room was packed. First things first, she supposed, and there were so many nagging questions about 61. What had happened? What had gone wrong? And why? 10 minutes listening, however, and her heart sank. People were upset, their recriminations heartfelt and bitter. Nadia's stomach knotted in a way it hadn't in years as memories of the failed revolt flooded into her. She looked around the room, trying to concentrate on the faces to distract herself from the ghosts within. Sachs was watching bird-like as he sat next to Spencer. He nodded as Spencer asserted that 2061 taught them that they needed a complete assessment of all the military forces in the Martian system. "This is a necessary precondition for any successful action," Spencer said. But this bit of common sense was shouted down by someone who seemed to consider it an excuse to avoid action, a Mars Firster, apparently, who advocated immediate mass écotage and armed assault on the cities. Quite vividly, Nadia recalled an argument with Arkady about this very matter, and suddenly she couldn't stand it. She walked down to the center of the room. After a while, everyone went silent, stilled by the sight of her. "I'm tired of this matter being discussed in purely military terms," she said. "The whole model of revolution has to be rethought. This is what Arkady failed to do in 61, and this is why 61 was such a bloody mess. Listen to me now. There can be no such thing as a successful, armed revolution on Mars. The life support systems are too vulnerable." Sachs croaked. "But if the surface is... vivable, is viable, then the support system's not so... Nadia shook her head. "The surface is not viable and won't be for many years, and even when it is, revolution has to be rethought. Look, even when revolutions have been successful, they have caused so much destruction and hatred that there is always some kind of horrible backlash. It's inherent in the method. If you choose violence, then you create enemies who will resist you forever. And ruthless men become your revolutionary leaders. So when the war is over, they're in power and likely to be as bad as what they replaced." "Not in American," Sachs said, cross-eyed with the effort to force the right words out in a timely manner. "I don't know about that, but mostly it's been true. Violence breeds hatred, and eventually there is a backlash. It's unavoidable." "Yes," said Nergal with his usual intent look, not all that different from Sax's grimace. "But if people are attacking the sanctuaries and destroying them, then we don't have much choice," Nadia said. "The question is, who's sending those forces out? And who are the people actually in these forces? I doubt that those individuals bear us any ill will. At this point, they might just as easily be on our side as against us. It's their commanders and owners we should focus on."
"Decapitation," Sachs said.
"I don't like the sound of that. You need a different term."
"Mandatory retirement,"
Maya suggested acidly. People laughed, and Nadia glared at her old friend.
"Forced disemployment,"
Art said loudly from the back, where he had just appeared.
"You mean a coup?" Maya said, not to fight the entire population on the surface, but just the leadership and their bodyguards.
And maybe their armies, Nergal insisted. We have no sign that they are disaffected or even apathetic.
No, but would they fight without orders from their leaders?
Some might. It's their job, after all.
Yes, but they have no great stake beyond that,
Nadia said, thinking it out as she spoke.
Without nationalism or ethnicity or some other kind of home feeling involved, I don't think these people will fight to the death. They know they're being ordered around to protect the powerful. Some more egalitarian system makes an appearance, and they might feel a conflict of loyalties.
Retirement benefits, Maya mocked, and people laughed again. But from the back, Art said, why not put it in those terms? If you don't want revolution conceptualized as war, you need something else to replace it, so why not economics? Call it a change in practice. This is what the people in Praxis are doing when they talk about human capital or bio-infrastructure, modeling everything in economic terms. It's ludicrous in a way, but it speaks to those for whom economics is the most important paradigm. That certainly includes the transnationals.
So, Nergal said with a grin, we disemploy the local leadership and give their police a raise while job retraining them.
Yeah, like that. Sax was shaking his head.
Can't reach them, he said. Need force.
Something has to be changed to avoid another 61, Nadia insisted. It has to be rethought. Maybe there are historical models, but not the ones you've been mentioning. Something more like the Velvet Revolutions that ended the Soviet era, for instance.
But those involved unhappy populations, Coyote said from the back, and took place in a system that was falling apart. The same conditions don't obtain here. People are pretty well off. They feel lucky to be here. But Earth... in trouble, Sax pointed out. Falling apart.
Coyote said, and he sat down by Sax to talk about it. Talking with Sax was still frustrating, but as a result of all his work with Michelle, it could be done. It made Nadia happy to see Coyote conferring with him. The discussion went on around them. People argued theories of revolution, and when they tried to talk about 61 itself, they were hampered by old grievances and a basic lack of understanding of what had happened in those nightmare months. At one point, this became especially clear, as Mikhail and some ex-Korolyov inmates began arguing about who had murdered the guards. Sax stood and waved his AI over his head.
Need facts first, he croaked. Then the dialysis. Analysis.
Good idea, Art said instantly. If this group can put together a brief history of the war to give to the Congress at large, that would be really useful. We can save the discussion of revolutionary methodology for the general meetings, okay?
Sax nodded and sat down.
Quite a few people left the meeting, and the rest calmed down and gathered around Sax and Spencer. Now they were mostly veterans of the war, Nadia noticed, but there also were Jackie and Nergal and some other natives. Nadia had seen some of the work Sax had done in Burrows on the question of 61, and she was hopeful that with eyewitness accounts from other veterans, they could come to some basic understanding of the war and its ultimate causes, nearly half a century after it was over, but as Art said when she mentioned this to him, that was not atypical. He walked with a hand on her shoulder, looking unconcerned by what he had seen that morning in his first full exposure to the fractious nature of the underground. They don't agree about much, he admitted, but it always starts that way. Late on the second afternoon, Nadia dropped in on the workshop devoted to the terraforming question. This was probably the most divisive issue facing them, Nadia judged, and attendance at the workshop reflected it. The room on the border of Leto's park was packed, and before the meeting began, the moderator moved it out into the park on the grass overlooking the canal. The Reds in attendance insisted that terraforming itself was an obstruction to their hopes. If the Martian surface became human viable, they argued, then it would represent an entire Earth's worth of land, and given the acute population and environmental problems on Earth, and the space elevator currently being constructed there to match the one already on Mars, the gravity wells could be surmounted, and mass emigration would certainly follow, and with it the disappearance of any possibility of Martian independence. People in favor of terraforming, called Greens, or just Green, as they were not a party as such, argued that with a human-viable surface it would be possible to live anywhere, and at that point the underground would be on the surface and infinitely less vulnerable to control or attack, and thus in a much better position to take over. These two views were argued in every possible combination and variation, and Anne Claiborne and Sax Russell were both there in the center of the meeting, making points more and more frequently, until the others in attendance stopped speaking, silenced by the authority of those two ancient antagonists, watching them go at it yet again. Nadia observed this slow-developing collision unhappily, anxious for her two friends, and she wasn't the only one who found the sight unsettling. Most of the people there had seen the famous videotape of Anne and Sax's argument in Underhill, and certainly their story was well known, one of the great myths of the First Hundred, a myth from a time when things had been simpler and distinct personalities could stand for clear-cut issues. Now, nothing was simple anymore, and as the old enemies faced off again in the middle of this new hodgepodge group, there was an odd electricity in the air, a mix of nostalgia and tension and collective déjà vu, and a wish, perhaps just in herself, Nadia thought bitterly, that the two of them could somehow effect a reconciliation, for their own sakes and for all of them. But there they were, standing in the center of the crowd. Anne had already lost this argument in the world itself, and her manner seemed to reflect this. She was subdued, disinterested, almost uninterested. The fiery Anne of the famous tapes was nowhere to be seen. "When the surface is viable," she said. "When," Nadia noted, not if. "They'll be here by the billions. As long as we have to live in shelters, logistics will keep the population in the millions, and that's the size it needs to be if you want a successful revolution." She shrugged. "You could do it today if you wanted. Our shelters are hidden, and theirs aren't. Break theirs open, they have no one to shoot back at. They die, you take over. Terraforming just takes away that leverage." "I won't be a part of that," Nadia said promptly, unable to help herself. "You know what it was like in the cities in 61. Hiroko was there, sitting at the back observing, and now she spoke out for the first time. "A nation founded in genocide is not what we want." Anne shrugged. "You want a bloodless revolution, but it's not possible." "It is," Hiroko said. "A silk revolution, an aerogel revolution, an integral part of the Areophany, that is what I want." "Okay," Anne said. No one could argue with Hiroko. It was impossible. "But even so, it would be easier if you didn't have a viable surface. This coup you're talking about, I mean, think about it. If you take over the power plants in the major cities and say, we're in control now, then the population is likely to agree out of necessity. If there are billions of people here, however, on a viable surface, and you disemploy some people and declare yourself in control, then they're likely to say, in control of what, and ignore you." "This," Sax said slowly, "this suggests takeover, while surface non-vivable, then continue process as independent." "They'll want you," Anne said. "When they see the surface open up, they'll come get you."
"Not if they collapse," Sax said.
"The transnationals are in firm control," Anne said. "Don't think they're not." Sachs was watching Anne most intently, and instead of dismissing her points, as he had in the debates of old, he seemed, on the contrary, hyper-focused on them, observing her every move, blinking as he considered her words, and then replying with even more hesitation than his speech problems would explain. With his altered face, it sometimes seemed to Nadia that someone else was arguing with her this time, not Sachs, but some brother of his, a dance instructor or ex-boxer with a broken nose and a speech impediment, struggling patiently to choose the right words and often failing. And yet the effect was the same.
Terraforming. Irreversible, he croaked. Would be tactically hard. Technically hard. To start. To stop. Effort equal to one. Made. And might not. And environment can be a weapon in our case. In our cause. At any stage.
How so? Several people asked, but Sachs did not elaborate. He was concentrating on Anne, who was looking back at him with a curious expression, as if exasperated. If we're on course to viability, she said to him, then Mars represents an incredible prize to the transnationals. Maybe even their salvation, if things go really wrong down there. They can come here and take over and have their own new world and let Earth go to hell. That being the case, we're out of luck. You saw what happened in 61. They have giant militaries at their disposal, and that's how they'll keep their power here. She shrugged. Sachs blinked as he considered this. He even nodded. Looking at them, Nadia felt her heart wrench. They were so dispassionate, it was almost as if they didn't care, or as if the parts of them that cared just barely outweighed the parts that didn't, and tipped the balance to speech. Anne, like a weather-beaten sodbuster from the early daguerreotypes, Sachs incongruously charming. They both appeared to be in their early 70s, so that seeing them and feeling her own nervous pulse, it was hard for Nadia to believe that they were over 120 now, inhumanly ancient, and so changed somehow, worn down, over-experienced, jaded, used up, or at the very least, long past getting too passionate about any mere exchange of words. They knew now how little importance words had in the world, and so they fell silent, still looking into each other's eyes, locked in a dialectic nearly drained of anger. But others more than compensated for their thoughtfulness, and the younger hotheads went at it hammer and tongs. The younger Reds regarded terraforming as nothing more than part of the imperial process. Anne was a moderate compared to them. They raged even at Hiroko in their fury. "Don't call it aerioforming," one of them shouted at her. And Hiroko stared nonplussed at this tall young woman, a blonde Valkyrie, made nearly rabid by the use of the word. "It's terraforming, you mean, and terraforming you're doing. Calling it aerioforming is a sickening lie." "We terraform the planet," Jackie said to the woman, "but the planet aerioforms us."
"And that's a lie, too."
Anne stared grimly at Jackie. "Your grandfather said that to me," she said, "a long time ago, as you may know. But I'm still waiting to see what aerioforming is supposed to mean." "It's happened to everyone born here," Jackie said confidently. "How so?" "You were born on Mars. How are you any different?" Jackie glowered. "Like the rest of the natives, Mars is all I know and all I care about. I was brought up in a culture made of strands from many different Terran predecessors, mixed to a new Martian thing." Anne shrugged. "I don't see how you're so different. You remind me of Maya."
"To hell with you!"
"As Maya would say, and that's your aerioforming. We're human, and human we remain, no matter what John Boone said. He said a lot of things, but none of them ever came true."
"Not yet," Jackie said.
"But the process is slowed when it's in the hands of people who haven't had a new thought for 50 years. A lot of the younger ones laughed at this.
and who are in the habit of introducing gratuitous personal insults into a political argument. And she stood there watching Anne, looking calm and relaxed, except for the flash in her eye, which reminded Nadia again of what a power Jackie was. Almost all the natives there were behind her, no doubt about it. "If we have not changed here," Hiroko said to Anne, "how do you explain your Reds? How do you explain the Areophany?" Anne shrugged. "They are the exceptions." Hiroko shook her head. "There is a spirit of place in us. Landscape has profound effects on the human psyche. You are a student of landscapes, and a Red. You must acknowledge this to be true."
"True for some," Anne replied, "but not for all. Most people obviously don't feel that spirit of place. One city is much like another. In fact, they're interchangeable in all the important ways. So people come to a city on Mars, and what's the difference? There isn't any. So they think no more of destroying the land outside the city than they did back on Earth."
"These people can be taught to think differently."
"No, I don't think they can. You've caught them too late. At best you can order them to act differently, but that's not being aerioformed by the planet. That's indoctrination, re-education camps, what have you. Fascist aerophony."
"Persuasion," Hiroko countered. "Advocacy, argument by example, argument by argument. It need not be coercive."
"The aerogel revolution," Anne said sarcastically. "But aerogel has very little effect on missiles."
Several people spoke at once, and for a moment the thread of discourse was lost. The discussion immediately fissioned into 100 smaller debates, as many there had something to say which they had been holding back. It was obvious they could go on like this for hour after hour, day after day. Anne and Sax sat back down. Nadia made her way out of the crowd, shaking her head. On the edge of the meeting, she ran into Art, who shook his head soberly. "Unbelievable," he said.
"Believe it."
The days of the Congress unfolded much as the first few had, with workshops, good or bad, leading to dinner, and then long evenings of talk or partying. Nadia noticed that while the old emigrants were likely to go back to work after dinner, the young natives tended to regard the conferences as daytime work only, with the nights given over to celebration, often around the big warm pond in Phaestus. Once again, this was only a matter of tendencies, with many exceptions either way, but she found it interesting. She herself spent most of her evenings on the Zaykros dining patios, making notes on the day's meetings, talking to people, thinking things over. Nergal often worked with her, and Art too, when he wasn't getting people who had been arguing during the day to drink kava together and then go up to party in Phaestus. In the second week, she got in the habit of taking an evening walk up the tube, often all the way to Thalassarna, after which she would walk back and join Nergal and Art for their final post-mortem on the day, which they convened on a patio set on a little lava knob in Leto. The two men had become good friends during their long trek home from Cassae Vallis, and under the pressure of the Congress they were becoming like brothers, talking over everything, comparing impressions, testing theories, laying out plans for Nadia's judgment, and deciding to take on the task of writing some kind of Congress document. She was part of it, the elder sister, perhaps, or maybe just the babushka. And once when they shut down and staggered off to bed, Art spoke of the triumvirate. With her as Pompey, no doubt, but she did her best to sway them with her analyses of the larger picture. There were many different kinds of disagreements among the groups there, she told them, but some were basic. There were those for and against terraforming. There were those for and against revolutionary violence. There were those who had gone underground to hold on to cultures under assault, and those who had disappeared in order to create radical new social orders. And it seemed more and more evident to Nadia that there were also significant differences between those who had immigrated from Earth and those who had been born on Mars. There were all kinds of disagreements then,
and no obvious alignments to be found among them. One night, Michel Duval joined the three of them for a drink, and as Nadia described to him the problem, he got out his AI and began to make diagrams based on what he called the semantic rectangle. Using this schema, they made 100 different sketches of the various dichotomies, trying to find a mapping that would help them to understand what alignments and oppositions might exist among them. They made some interesting patterns, but it couldn't be said that any blinding insights jumped off the screen at them, although one particularly messy semantic rectangle seemed suggestive, at least to Michelle. Violence and nonviolence, terraforming and anti-terraforming formed the initial four corners, and in the secondary combination around this first rectangle, he had located Bogdanovists, Reds, Hiroko's Ariophany, and the Muslims and other cultural conservatives. But what this combinatoire indicated in terms of action was not clear. Nadia began to attend the daily meetings devoted to general questions concerning a possible Martian government. These were just as disorganized as the discussions of revolutionary methods, but less emotional and often more substantive. They took place every day in a small amphitheater which the Minoans had cut into the side of the tunnel in Malia. From this rising arc of benches, the participants looked out over bamboo and pine trees and terracotta rooftops all the way up and down the tunnel from Zaykros to Phalasarna. The talks were attended by a somewhat different crowd than the revolutionary debates. A report would come in from the smaller workshops for discussion, and then most of the people who had attended that workshop would join the larger meeting to see what comments were made on the report. The Swiss had set up workshops for all aspects of politics, economics, and culture generally, and so the general discussions were very wide-ranging indeed. Vlad and Marina sent over frequent reports from their workshop on finances, each report sharpening and expanding their evolving concept of eco-economics. "It's very interesting," Nadia reported to Nergal and Art in their nightly gathering on the Knob patio. "A lot of people are critiquing Vlad and Marina's original system, including the Swiss and the Bolognese, and they're basically coming around to the conclusion that the gift system that we first used in the underground is not sufficient by itself because it's too hard to keep balanced. There are problems of scarcity and hoarding, and when you start to set standards, it's like compelling gifts from people, which is a contradiction. This is what Coyote always said, and why he set up his barter network. So they're working toward a more rationalized system in which basic necessities are distributed in a regulated hydrogen peroxide economy where things are priced by calculations of their caloric value. Then, when you get past the necessities, the gift economy comes into play using a nitrogen standard. So there are two planes, the need and the gift, or what the Sufis in the workshop call the animal and the human, expressed by the different standards." "The green and the white," Nergal said to himself. "And are the Sufis pleased with this dual system?" Art asked. Nadia nodded. "Today, after Marina described the relationship of the two planes, Duel Nun said to her, the Mevlana couldn't have put it any better." "A good sign," Art said cheerfully. Other workshops were less specific and therefore less fruitful. One, working on a prospective Bill of Rights, was surprisingly ill-natured, but Nadia quickly saw that this topic tapped into a huge well of cultural concerns. Many obviously considered the topic an opportunity for one culture to dominate the rest. "I've said it ever since Boone," Zake exclaimed. "An attempt to impose one set of values on all of us is nothing but Ataturkism. Everyone must be allowed their own way."
"But this can only be true up to a point," said Ariadne. "What if one group here asserts its right to own slaves?"
Zake shrugged.
"This would be beyond the pale."
"So you agree there should be some basic Bill of Human Rights?"
"This is obvious," Zake replied coldly.
Mikhail spoke for the Bogdanovists.
"All social hierarchy is a kind of slavery," he said. "Everyone should be completely equal under the law."
"Hierarchy is a natural fact," Zake said. "It cannot be avoided."
"Spoken like an Arab man," Ariadne said. But we are not natural here. We are Martian, and where hierarchy leads to oppression, it must be abolished.
The hierarchy of the right-minded, Zake said.
Or the primacy of equality and freedom.
Enforced, if necessary?
Yes.
Enforced freedom, then.
Zake waved a hand, disgusted. Art rolled a drink card onto the stage.
Maybe we should focus on some actual rights, he suggested. Maybe look at the various declarations of human rights from Earth and see if they can be adapted to suit us here.
Nadia moved on to check out some of the other meetings. Land use, property law, criminal law, inheritance. The Swiss had broken down the matter of government into an amazing number of subcategories. The anarchists were irritated, Mikhail chief among them.
Do we really have to go through all this? He asked again and again. None of this should obtain, none of it.
Nadia would have expected Coyote to be among those arguing with him, but in fact, he said,
We have to argue all of it. Even if you want no state or a minimal state, then you still have to argue it point by point. Especially since most minimalists want to keep exactly the economic and police system that keeps them privileged. That's libertarians for you. Anarchists who want police protection from their slaves. No, if you want to make the minimum state case, you have to argue it from the ground up. But, Mikhail said, I mean, inheritance law. Sure, why not? This is critical stuff. I say there should be no inheritance at all, except for a few personal objects passed on, perhaps. But all the rest should go back to Mars. It's part of the gift, right?
All the rest? Vlad inquired with interest.
But what would that consist of, exactly? No one will own any of the land, water, air, the infrastructure, the gene stock, the information pool. What's left to pass on?
Coyote shrugged.
Your house? Your savings account? I mean, won't we have money, and won't people stockpile surpluses of it if they can?
You have to come to the finance sessions, Marina said to Coyote. We're hoping to base money on units of hydrogen peroxide and price things by energy values.
But money will still exist, right?
Yes, but we are considering reverse interest on savings accounts, for instance, so that if you don't put what you've earned back into use, it will be released to the atmosphere as nitrogen. You'd be surprised how hard it is to keep a positive personal balance in this system.
But if you did it...
Well, then I agree with you. On death, it should pass back to Mars, be used for some public purpose. Sachs haltingly objected that this contradicted the bioethical theory that human beings, like all animals, were powerfully motivated to provide for their own offspring. This urge could be observed throughout nature and in all human cultures, explaining much behavior, both self-interested and altruistic.
Try to change the baby-logical, the biological basis of culture by decree, asking for trouble. Maybe there should be a minimal inheritance allowed, Coyote said. Enough to satisfy that animal instinct, but not enough to perpetuate a wealthy elite.
Marina and Vlad clearly found this intriguing, and they began to tap new formulas into their AIs. But Mikhail, sitting by Nadia and flipping through his program for the day, was still frustrated.
Is this really part of a constitutional process? He said, looking at the list. Zoning codes, energy production, waste disposal, transport systems, pest management, property law, grievance systems, criminal law... Arbitration. Health codes.
Nadia sighed. I guess so. Remember how Arkady worked so hard on architecture?
School schedules? I mean, I've heard of micropolitics, but this is ridiculous.
Nanopolitics, Art said.
No, picopolitics. Femtopolitics.
Nadia got up to help Art push the drink cart to the workshops in the village below the amphitheater. Art was still running from one meeting to the next, wheeling in food and drink, then catching a few minutes of the talk before moving on. There were 8 to 10 meetings per day, and Art was still dropping in on all of them. In the evenings, while more and more of the delegates spent their time partying or going for walks up and down the tunnel, Art continued to meet with Nergal, and they watched tapes at a moderate fast forward so that everyone spoke like a bird, only slowing them down to take notes or talk over some point or other. Getting up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, Nadia would pass the dim lounge where the two of them worked on their write-ups and see the two of them asleep in their chairs, their slack, open-mouthed faces flickering under the light of the Keystone Cops debate on the screen. But in the mornings, Art was up with the Swiss getting things started. Nadia tried to keep pace with him for a few days, but found that the breakfast workshops were chancy. Sometimes people sat around tables sipping coffee and eating fruit and muffins, staring at each other like zombies. "Who are you?" their bleary gazes said. "What am I doing here? Where are we? Why aren't I asleep in my bed?" But it could be just the opposite. Some mornings people came in showered and refreshed, alert with coffee or kava java, full of new ideas and ready to work hard to make progress. If the others were of like mind, things could really fly. One of the sessions on property went like that, and for an hour it seemed as though they had solved all the problems of reconciling self and society, private opportunity and the common good, selfishness and altruism. At the end of the session, however, their notes looked just about as vague and contradictory as those taken at any of the more fractious meetings. "It's the tape of the whole session that will have to represent it," Art said after trying to write down a summary. The majority of the meetings, however, weren't as successful. In fact, most of them were merely protracted arguments. One morning, Nadia came in on Antar, the young Arab whom Jackie had spent time with during their tour, saying to Vlad, "You will only repeat the socialist catastrophe." Vlad shrugged. "Don't be too hasty to judge that period. The socialist countries were under assault from capitalism without and corruption within, and no system could survive that. We must not throw the baby socialism out with the Stalinist bathwater, or we lose many concepts of obvious fairness that we need. Earth is in the grip of the system that defeated socialism, and it's clearly an irrational and destructive hierarchy. So how can we deal with it without being crushed? We have to look everywhere for answers to this, including the systems that the current order defeated." Art was pulling a food cart to the next room, and Nadia left with him. "Man, I wish Fort was here," Art muttered. "He should be. I really think he should." In the next meeting, they were arguing about the limits to tolerance, the things that simply wouldn't be allowed, no matter what religious meaning anyone gave them, and someone shouted, "Tell that to the Muslims!" Jürgen came out of the room looking disgusted. He took a roll from the cart and walked with them, talking through his food. "Liberal democracy says that cultural tolerance is essential, but you don't have to get very far away from liberal democracy for liberal Democrats to get very intolerant." "How do the Swiss solve that?" Art asked. Jürgen shrugged. "I don't think we do." "Man, I wish Fort were here," Art said. "I tried to reach him a while back and tell him about this. I even used the Swiss government lines, but I never got any reply." The Congress went on for almost a month. Sleep deprivation and perhaps an over-reliance on kava made Art and Nergal increasingly haggard and groggy until Nadia started coming by at night and putting them to bed, pushing them onto couches, and promising to write summaries of the tapes they hadn't reviewed. They would sleep right there in the room, muttering as they rolled over on the narrow foam and bamboo couches. One night, Art sat up suddenly from his couch.
"I'm losing the content of things," he said to Nadia seriously, still half-dreaming. "I'm just seeing forms now."
"Becoming Swiss, eh? Go back to sleep." He flopped back down.
"It was crazy to think you folks could do anything together," he murmured. "Go back to sleep."
probably it was crazy, she thought as he snuffed and snored. She stood up, went to the door. She felt the mental whir in her head that told her she wasn't going to be able to sleep, and walked outside into the park. The air was still warm, the black skylight stuffed with stars. The length of the tunnel suddenly reminded her of one of the full rooms on the Ares, here vastly enlarged, but with the same aesthetics employed. Dimly lit pavilions, the dark furry clumps of little forests. A world-building game. But now there was a real world at stake. At first, the attendants of the Congress had been almost giddy with the enormous potential of it, and some, like Jackie and other natives, were young and irrepressible enough to feel that way still. But for a lot of the older representatives, the intractable problems were beginning to reveal themselves like knobby bones under shrinking flesh. The remnant of the first 100, the old Japanese from Sabishi, they sat around these days watching, thinking hard, with attitudes ranging from Maya's cynicism to Marina's anxious irritation. And then there was the coyote, down below her in the park, strolling tipsily out of the woods with a young woman holding him by the waist. "Ah, love!" he shouted down the long tunnel, throwing his arms wide. "Could thou and I with fate conspire to grasp this sorry scheme of things entire? Would we not shatter it to bits and then remold it nearer to the heart's desire?" Indeed, Nadia thought, smiling, and went back to her room. There were some reasons for hope. For one thing, Hiroko persevered, attending meetings all day long, adding her thoughts and giving people the sense that they had chosen the most important meeting going on at that moment. And Anne worked, though she seemed critical of everything, Nadia thought, blacker than ever. And Spencer and Sax, and Maya and Michelle, and Vlad and Ursula and Marina. Indeed, the first 100 seemed to Nadia more united in this effort than in anything they had done since setting up Underhill, as if this were their last chance to get things right, to recover from the damage done, to make something for their dead friend's sake. And they weren't the only ones to work. As the meetings went on, people got a sense of who wanted the Congress to achieve something tangible, and these people got in the habit of attending the same meetings, working hard on finding compromises and getting results onto screens in the form of recommendations and the like. They had to tolerate visits by those who were more interested in grandstanding than results, but they kept hammering away. Nadia focused on these signs of progress and worked to keep Nergal and Art informed, also fed and rested. People dropped by their suite. "We were told to bring this over to the Big Three." Many of the serious workers were interesting. One of the women from Dorsa Brevia named Charlotte was a constitutional scholar of some note, and she was building a kind of framework for them, a Swiss-like thing in which topics to be dealt with were ordered without being filled in. "Cheer up," she told the three of them one morning when they were sitting around looking glum. "A clash of doctrines is an opportunity. The American Constitutional Congress was one of the most successful ever, and they went into it with several very strong antagonisms. The shape of the government they made reflects the distrust these groups had for each other. Small states came in afraid they were going to be overwhelmed by large states, and so there's a Senate, where all states are equals, and a House, where the larger states have their greater numbers represented. The structure is a response to a specific problem, see? Same with the three-way checks and balances. It's an institutionalized distrust of authority. The Swiss Constitution has a lot of that, too, and we can do it here." So out they went, ready to work, two sharp young men and one blunt old woman. It was strange, Nadia thought, to see who emerged as leaders in situations like these. It wasn't necessarily the most brilliant or well-informed, as Marina or Coyote would serve to show, though both qualities helped, and those two people were important. But the leaders were the ones people would listen to, the magnetic ones. and in a crowd of such powerful intellects and personalities, such magnetism was very rare, very elusive, very powerful.
This ends side 1 of cassette 12. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.